You're listening to the Belfer Center's Office Hours. Watch highlights from this and other Office Hours interviews on YouTube at youtube.com/Belfer Center. I spoke with Prime Minister Ehud Barak, who served as Israel's Prime Minister from 1999 to 2001. Prime Minister Barak later served as Israel's Minister of Defense from 2007 to 2013 and is the most decorated soldier in Israel's history. He is also a non-resident senior fellow at the Belfer Center. You've served as the foreign minister, as the defense minister, as the prime minister. You were head of the Israeli Defense Forces. You've done it all. As like a kid, did you hold all the positions in student government in high school? What were you like?
No, never. I was a totally introvert young man.
Really?
I found my new way into action only when I joined the armed forces and find myself in a unit that later on became the Special Forces unit of Israel, the equivalent of American SEAL Team 6 or the Delta Forces, long before these two units came into existence. And I started there as a young soldier, and within 12 or 13 years became the commander of this unit. And that's already decided my life into the arena of action.
Right.
I studied a little bit because of some curiosity about science, especially. Studied mathematics and physics at the first degree and then had a master's degree at Stanford University in system analysis, something like this. And that's it.
And you thought public service was not something that you imagined at the time, but until you became the head of the Israeli Defense Forces, is that when it kind of... You know,
I found myself, I never thought of myself as a career military player, but I was dragged from one event to the other event in Israel. It was very intensive. We had several wars since I became a soldier and there were two intifadas and infinite number of other operations. So I found myself dragged by the sense of mission and sense of, and probably also private enthusiasm and interest about all these things that I ended up with 36 years in uniform, but mm-hmm. never planned it, so to speak.
Right. You had such a career in military service and in public service. I'm kind of curious to know what would have been your career path had you not taken the military path?
I don't know. I don't know for sure. I probably, following my father's expectation, I probably would have become a scientist.
A scientist.
Yeah. And in fact,
you're a physics major, you said.
Yeah. I found a lot of interest in mainly in physics and mathematics as a young person. But when I studied, I had to compare the intensive interest, adrenaline and everything that goes with spatial operation to flying into these abstract models of great mathematicians, group theory, or the derivatives and integrals and so on. So I found the action path more, at least more stimulating at that age. And that's how life, we had not yet invented machine that will turn the time arrow the other direction and enable us to live it again. So you have to live up with what you have, with the accumulated choices of your life.
And did you have any other hobbies? I've heard you're a piano player.
Yeah, I play piano from very early age. Oh. I played some 10 years even before I joined the armed forces. Then I left it for 20 years.
Do you still play now?
Now I play more, yeah.
Oh, what do you like to play?
Yeah, for you, no.
Oh, no, what do you like to play?
I play classical music, basically.
All classical music.
Yeah.
And where do you find the time? Is that something that you...
Sometimes at night, sometimes during daytime. Sometimes I don't play for several weeks. And when I come back, I have to get to the tempo once again. It's not easy at my age.
You're also a strategic thinker, thinking about the world. It's the current events. And I want to start to talk a little bit about what's going on in the world today, where the world is heading and what your sense of things is. Help me understand the Middle East today. What are the new dynamics that we should be paying attention to? What's changing? What's going on?
I think that the Middle East finds itself in a global storm. The whole world order is changing the last 5 years or so. in front of our eyes. But the Middle East is deep in the way. Swirl of its own, it just, not just the clash of civilizations that Huntington predicted between Islam and the West, but also a major struggle within Islam about identity, how to tackle moderna, how to bridge the gaps between such different attitude that are expressed in some versions of Islam.
Do you have any optimism about that? Do you think that's something that's, it's obviously very complicated to resolve.
You know, in the Middle East, we usually say that an optimist is, or no, the other way, that a pessimist is an optimist with experience. So you get experience, you cannot be very optimistic. You know, we all watched elated the eruption of the Arab Spring some 5 years ago in Tunisia, later on all around the Arab world. And within 5 short years, it turned into Islamist winter, which is dark and painful and with a huge slaughtering of human beings en masse by Muslims. Many more Muslims were killed by other Muslims than any infidels, Christians or Jews along those many years. Nation states have been collapsed and borders have been erased, and it's still running there, and it's quite disturbing.
Is the U.S. powerless in this situation? Why is the U.S. so bad at Middle East policy?
It is not fully clear. In a way, the United States, you know, the world, the whole world lost its geopolitical center of gravity. It's not anymore the two poles situation of the Cold War, not the multipolar world of post the demise of the Soviet Union. It is now the whole world turned into one big gestalt where everything dependent on everything else. America is by far the only superpower which remained active, not just militarily or strategically, but in almost any other aspect. But it is perceived as weak and weakening, and perception works these days as reality. So if America perceived to be weak and weakening, it acts as if these were the realities. It started with Bush and the neocons and continued with Obama. And now it will come to a test with Trump. Objectively speaking, America is the only superpower, as I've mentioned. Just think of the defense budget. The American defense budget is bigger than the combined defense budgets of China, Russia, the United Kingdom, France, and half a dozen other leading players. So it's still the most powerful player, but it behaved, you know, in the last 12 years, or 16 years, in fact, since Bush Jr. started, America always carried the moral beacon for the world, for freedom, human rights, democracy, and so on. But when it came to deal with the details, especially in the Middle East, both the neocons of Bush Jr. as well as the ultra-liberals of Obama left too many points where clumsy behavior overshadowed the great ideals they were serving.
Ask you mentioned Trump earlier in a big something of a promise he's made is to move the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Is that a good idea? Is it a good idea to move the embassy to Jerusalem?
Yeah, for us, for Israel, it's an old dream of decades that not just America, that all countries in the world will move their embassies into our capital, which is Jerusalem. It was delayed for many years, and it's not free of certain hurdles along the way when they will actually do it. They have not yet done it.
Right.
They just talk about it.
But the concern, of course, is...
But I think that it's basically positive. But of course, Israel and Americans have certain responsibility to try to mitigate the unintended consequence of such a step and to make it as smooth as possible under the circumstances.
Wait, so are you, in your judgment, the it wouldn't lead to, I think a lot of people, a lot of analysts are worried that it would lead to unrest, that you would see riots or some sort of uprising among the Arab communities.
I hope not. I think that basically the very idea that the American embassy is moved into Israel's capital is not something that's dramatic, but it's true that it got a lot of symbolic weight to it along the years after so many years of American refusal to do it. I think that always certain steps could be taken to mitigate, as I described it, the risk that something unexpected, unpredicted, or unintended will follow.
Do Israelis like Trump? What's your sense of the Israeli public?
I think the Israeli public as a whole likes Trump very, very much. And because there was a probably unjustified, but there was probably, but there was certain kind of animosity toward Obama that was nurtured by different political circles in Israel. There is a feeling now that with Trump it'll be okay. But I think that Obama was a great president for Israel.
Was the animosity towards Obama from the leadership politically, or was it from the population?
You cannot fully differentiate between the two because the public listens to the leadership and so on. But certain political circles were interested in demonizing Obama for no reason. Right? From point of view of Israel security, he was one of the best ever. Supported Israel unconditionally in a way that some of it are still far from the public eye. And I think that he should have been kind of highly respected for his devotion and the contribution to the attempt to make things better. After all, he cannot replace neither the Palestinian nor the Israeli in solving the issue.
What I don't understand is that if he was objectively good for Israeli security, then why? And why was it? Why was it so tense? Why was it so bad?
Because politics is, you will, when you complete your PhD, you will realize that politics is not that naive and sometimes have kind of short of perfect considerations behind what happens. And you can never penetrate it. You cannot read the souls of political players. But I put it as a matter of fact that Obama was good for Israel and for its security. And I hope, I have no reason to believe that Trump will be bad for Israel. The opposite. It's according to his record and behavior until now, he sounds very friendly and probably will be very good for Israel. I will be happy to see it happens.
You've mentioned in the past that I want to move to ISIS and some of the other dynamics in the region. That ISIS should be defeated by Muslims. Is it impossible for the West to defeat ISIS fully? What did you mean by that?
No, technically it's not that complicated to defeat ISIS. If the Israeli armed forces for some reason would put it as its objective and had the international legitimacy to enter wherever ISIS is deployed, or if any kind of modern fighting force, American or European, would have the full permission to do it, it won't be a very complicated military or operational challenge.
But nobody wants to do it. Is that the idea?
No, it's not because they don't. Probably they won't, probably they don't. But it's not the right way. If a Christian or Jewish force will try to destroy them, it will backfire at us. It will just raise, not decrease, the potential, the mobilization potential, the attraction of ISIS and the commitment of its fighters. So because it's a phenomenon that emerged from within the Muslim world, and they actually killed much more Muslims than infidels or whatever, or crusaders, as they called it, it is essential they will be defeated on the ground by a Muslim led
in a way to delegitimize coalition. Their
in order to be to make it clear that they destroyed by from within Islam, that they are against Islam. They are not the saviors of Islam, they are the worst enemies of proper Islam. And it's important historically that they will be defeated by Muslim forces. So it could be Turkey, could do it easily, could be done by a combination of locals, Iraq and others, Kurds in the in Iraq, or probably a different combination in Syria, but that's basically the situation which is needed. Of course, we have to help them with intelligence. We, the West, should help them more with intelligence, with some air support, or some, probably some special forces individuals, but basically the bulwark of it should be done by Muslims.
But if it's so easy, I mean, if it's so easy to beat them, and the United States hasn't quite been able to do it yet, and that's because there's not the political will to put boots on the ground. Does that mean that it's better for the United States to pull back a little bit so that the Muslim countries are more greatly threatened by ISIS, and then therefore they will actually take it seriously?
So ISIS was very effective on the YouTube, very effective in spreading the word for lone wolves all over the world. They were very effective in sowing fear in Nice, in Paris, in Brussels, in Moscow, probably even on American soil. But as a military force, they are ridiculous. It's 50,000 people riding on 5,000 Toyota pickups with World War II machine guns. That's ridiculous force. Americans cannot deploy because it will backfire. It will help them. To be deployed against American forces,
it's a sign of legitimacy.
101 division or the 82nd or whatever, that would be great for them. But they have to be to face the Muslim, and that's what basically they are doing. And it's a little bit clumsy that it had not been done in the past, but nowadays it's beyond American control. Once Putin is there, after America missed at least two opportunities to find a way to defeat Assad and probably to control ISIS people. So now Putin is there, and it's not American role anymore. They can help in Iraq to defeat ISIS in Mosul, but when it comes to Syria, Raqqa or Deir ez-Zor, that would be done by probably the Turks and Kurds in coordination with the Russians and some others.
I want to move on to the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. Now, every couple months it comes up, the issue of settlements. And for some reason, it's such a big issue, even though 80% of Israeli settlers live in three blocks, and that's going to go back to Israel. And of course, when you were prime minister, the deals that were being proposed, it was only a couple percent of the territory, really, that we're talking about. So it's not that big of a deal, but and it also wasn't quite the stumbling block in the peace process. Why do people care about settlements so much?
It's a both emotional and security issue in Israel and big political issue, and basically it's a irreplaceable element is missing now from the picture. That's trust. You cannot even try to strike a deal without certain level of trust between the two sides and probably even the sponsor.
So that it erodes trust.
Yeah. Nowadays the trust was totally eroded. The main responsibility lies on the shoulders of the Palestinians. They made too many mistakes. Certain mistakes were done by Europe and the United States, and probably some mistakes by Israel as well. But the reality is now that there is no enough trust to start something. Nothing is not beyond recuperation right now.
You don't think it's beyond?
No, I don't think so. I think it could reach a point of no return, but then we have a responsibility to block it from reaching there. Yeah. But it's not yet there. And basically, I think that there is an opportunity now based on the regional conference that is needed to bring together the Sunnite banana from the Emirates, the Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan, probably Turkey is not exactly Arab, but still Sunnite. And hopefully Israel, to create this huge conference on regional cooperation with three objectives. Fighting radical Muslim terror, putting at bay the hegemonic and nuclear intentions of Iran, and joining hands in huge infrastructure projects. It has to do with water, with transportation, with energy, climate, and so on, that are needed urgently for the whole region. Now, within the context of such a regional conference, Israel can try to promote its relationship with the Palestinians based on a intermediate agreement. Israel cannot afford losing full control of security all over the area as long as there is no satisfying replacement security arrangements. And that's it. And we should move forward. I think that the fact that our government and other governments are not yet involved in this is a grave mistake of all players.
I mean, you still believe a two-state solution is possible?
Yeah, for sure it's possible.
For sure. Last question. I'm told that you like watches and clocks.
You have an interesting old one.
Oh, yeah. This is I don't know, Ben, if you can get a close-up of this guy. This is quite nice. It's a Garland. Are you familiar with? It's an old...
American.
It's an old 1940s department watch. Now, this is actually, I have to confess, it's a friend of mine bought it for his wife, and I heard that you like antique watches, so I asked her to borrow it. So we both have dressed up like women.
Okay.
Now, what is it about watches that you enjoy so much? Is it the structure?
I was born in a remote rural area in Israel. And could never see something. I still remember the first time I saw my father open the backside of his watch, and I thought that I just couldn't believe that human beings were subtle enough, accurate enough, creative enough to be able to produce this machine that looks like a pumping heart. It looked with such a finesse and delicacy that I became mesmerized from ever on these machines, and I enjoyed it. I enjoyed taking it off, trying to build it again, and end up without extra part in my hand and the machine that works. And it's quite challenging to do.
I feel like that explains a lot of your interest in physics, and that's where it... Prime Minister Barak, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
This was an absolute pleasure.
Thank you.
Office Hours was produced by the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government.